Join me in the book of Job. 4,000 years ago. Job is a contemporary Jacob and Isaac, living about 4,000 years ago. I want us to look at chapter 1 in particular and deal with this second principle of leadership, and that is this: leaders don't panic. Leaders don't panic. I made a statement in the last session that the crisis or trial of your life, such as Job experienced in a single day, reveals your character. It exposes who you are when you have a day like Job had and we're about to read about. And so, understanding as we approach this passage that in 1 Corinthians 10, that God does not allow us to go through anything that we can't handle through His strength. Okay, so fundamental to crisis in general, if He allows you to have a life of suffering, a life of difficulty, and a life of tribulation. And Job later says, by the way, Job 14:1, man was born in adversity. So trials and difficulties and challenges are just part of life. It's part of living in a Genesis 3 world. So you're growing up in a Genesis 3 world. By that I mean there's depravity, there's the fall, and depravity, and the fruit of sin is manifest everywhere and touches everything, down to the plant life. And so because you live in a Genesis 3 world, it's not if you're going to go through a difficult time, it's when. And if you're younger, it's perhaps not happened to you. It may have happened to your family or someone close to you, for sure. But typically, when you've only had so many years on the planet, you haven't been exposed to what you probably will be exposed to in a long life, and that is tremendous difficulty. So, baseline, God doesn't allow you to go through anything that He doesn't equip you to handle or to go through, including Job. So you're going to see God's compliment to Job by allowing him to go through this massive amount of suffering and to experience that. We shouldn't think it's strange. I'll just read a couple passages as kind of the porch to Job chapter 1. First Peter writes to them in chapter 4, and he states that we shouldn't think it's strange. Listen to what Peter says. Beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the suffering of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of His glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory in God rests upon you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer, thief, evildoer, or troublesome meddler. In other words, bringing it on yourself. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in his name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that righteousness is saved, what will become of the goodness, godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. So we shouldn't think it's strange to go through trials. Trials happen to everyone, every family, every person, because we live in a Genesis 3 world. What makes the story of Job unique, though, and its application to leadership, is that in a single day, Job experienced what you're about to read. So this was a nightmare of all nightmares. It was the worst case scenario. Do you remember Steve Saint mentioning last night that worst day of his life? This is Job's worst day. And I want you to see that character is king for Job, as we're going to see in a minute. And I want you to see his response. Okay, so we're just going to walk through Job and extract leadership principles out of this story. And the reason why I've selected Job is because it's a timeless, universal application to those of you who want to be leaders. Again, 4,000 years ago, this book was written. And so It's a fascinating study on leadership and to show the timeless nature of leadership, that God's expectations on leaders have always been the case. So, leadership principle number one, character is king. Leadership principle number two, Job chapter one, leaders don't panic. Let's read the text. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And the man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. This man had seven sons, three daughters were born to him. His possessions were also 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of the men of the east of Palestine. His sons used to go and hold a feast at their house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with him. Now, when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them. He'd rise up early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. And Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did this continually. Now there's a transition in the passage, verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where did you come? Where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, and only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. I want you to stop right there, and we're going to pick up the rest of the story. So this is kind of there's three acts to the story, and I want us to kind of go back and build the first two and then punctuate it with the third. Let me tell you everything I know about the book of Job, trying to give you some context. One of the oldest books written, probably the oldest book written in the Old Testament. So it's not in chronological order beginning in Genesis, but Job is probably one of the oldest books. So he would be, you know, after Babel, but before Moses. And he would be in that time slot, Jacob, Abraham. These would be contemporaries of Job. And so Job is a fascinating book. Job, the name itself means much persecuted. So his Hebrew name, if was translated for us, it would mean much persecuted. And you're about to see his persecution and the exposure of that. Now, when somebody goes through a day like this, I think the natural tendency is to offer up some explanation for why he's suffering. You know, I mean, that's the natural fleshly response. Why is somebody suffering so intensely? What would be some possible options here? What are some of the reasons why people suffer? What are some possible reasons why people go through suffering?
Mistakes.
Okay, or sin? Let's just say sin. It's possible that you bring a trial on yourself by your own sin, right? Hebrews 12 and 13 make it clear in that passage that whom the Lord loves, chapter 12 in particular, whom the Lord loves, he chastens, right? He disciplines. Every son that he has that goes out of line, he'll discipline them. So it's possible, Numbers 12 says, be sure your sins will find you out. It's possible that you sin in such a way that you get God's attention. It evokes chastening. Because God loves you, it's an expression of his love, and he pursues you in discipline. So it's possible that mistake, sin, has caused a trial such as significant as the one Job is about to experience, right? It's possible. What are some other explanations?
God testing you.
Could be a testing, right? Could be some kind of test that you need to go through. And what happens is, I'll spin that a little bit. 2 Corinthians 1 says that God allows us to go through suffering so that we would be able to teach other people as a ministry. So we would be able to comfort them by the same comfort we've been comforted by the Lord. So we go through the test. We learn God's strength. We learn faith. We learn trust. And again, there's a reproduction principle. He's expecting us to reproduce that comfort, that same comfort in other people's lives. And so it's a ministry. So sometimes we just go through suffering because it's a ministry, it's a test, and out of that should come an education of some sorts, and then you're supposed to pass that on. You're supposed to reproduce that in other people's lives so that when they go through the same kind of suffering, you could come alongside of them and say, man, brother, I know what you're going through. I mean, this is difficult, this was challenging, and I've been there. And so sometimes that is the occasion. So I think the natural tendency for all of us is to offer up some explanation on why we go through suffering, right? I mean, that's just the first thing we do. We think, why? And it's typically, if you see someone going through suffering, you're like, psh, that guy must have really messed up. Here's what's fascinating about the account of Job. Job did nothing wrong. Job was, as a matter of fact, doing everything right. He was at the top of his game, the zenith of his career. I mean, he's hitting on all cylinders. I mean, he's got the highest batting average of anyone. I mean, he's scoring all the points. I mean, this guy is a machine when it comes to living a godly life. His character is completely intact. How do we know that? Look at verse 1. There was a man who lived in the land of Uz, whose name was Job, much persecuted. And look at what the writer of Job says about him. And that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. So, we know that Job didn't sin in such a grievous way as to get the chastisement of the Lord. It's nothing he did wrong. As a matter of fact, he's doing everything right. So he's working on his character. He's being a consummate leader. He's shepherding people. I mean, this is just an incredible man. And look at all the things that, look at the resume this guy has. He was blameless or mature. Your text says perfect. He's blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. So he deals with his sin. He's got an unimpeachable character. He's upright, he's fearing God, and he's turning away from evil. Listen, that phrase there is significant because that's a man who has an understanding of leadership. 4,000 years old, he understood that character was king. And character was what was going to take him and give him the capacity to not panic in his leadership when the crisis came. So the author of the book of Job says this about Job. Let's step it up one more time. Look at verse 8. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on earth. He's a blameless, upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. Okay, so now you have God saying this about his character. So you have the writer of Job saying it. You have God saying it. But who would know Job best, right? His own family, right? His wife. His wife would know him best if his private life was weird. He had this great public life. These are all public persona about his life. And maybe his private life was undermining all that. Then his wife would kind of expose him and call him out, right? Go to chapter 2. Look what she says. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. So at the end of the trial, she's calling him to say, golly, you must have offended God and he no longer loves you, so move on. But do you notice what she says about him? Do you still hold fast your integrity? If you take verse 1 and verse 8 and you would give a single one-word description of his character, it would be a man of integrity. So his wife says that he's a man of integrity. God says he's a man of integrity. The writer of Job says he's a man of integrity. And James, if we'd fast forward all the way to the book of James, James chapter 5 says that Job was a man of integrity. So the consensus from everyone that knew Job is that his character was intact. He was a genuine leader who had complete capacity and had developed this robust character. Okay, so he's about to experience the day from hell. And he's got character, and character is king. Let's move on. Then the text talks about his 7 sons and 3 daughters. Sons in the ancient times were worth more than daughters, so he's again showing the blessings of the Lord. seven sons, three daughters. And then we can kind of date the book by verse 3. Notice that they measure his wealth. Not only is he a godly man, but he's a wealthy man. Verse 3 says they quantify his livestock. And that's just to help us understand that he was a very wealthy man. He was a very capable man. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camel, 5,000 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. So what he's basically saying is he's at the zenith of his career. He's got tons of... He's feeding over 11,000 mouths right now. I mean, that's a significant businessman. And the text says he's greatest of all the men east of Palestine. So that tells you he's a wealthy man. He's at the top of his game. I mean, life was good in Uz. I mean, he's got a lot of things. I mean, this is a man of capacity and a man of means. Then the text transitions in verses 4 and 5. It talks about him being a family man. And ever so often, in one of the kids, one of the 10 children, they would celebrate their birthday or an anniversary. And they would get together and they'd come over and eat at Job Jr.'s house, and there would be festivities and celebration. Well, Job Sr. was so concerned that in the midst of their celebration and midst of their celebrating and the festivities, that they would somehow curse God. They would somehow sin before the Lord and do something stupid. And so Job would get up before they would get up the next morning, and he would go offer a sacrifice. Now, this is before the sacrificial system, okay? So this is prior to the law being instituted and prior to the sacrificial system, which dates it back to, again, 4,000 years. This is pre all of that. And Job is basically being a dutiful father, and he's covering his children. He's like your parents might come into your room and pray over you when you're sleeping and say, Lord, keep them, bless them, protect them, help him to make wise decisions. It's just a signature in the text that he is a dutiful father caring for his family and for his children. And the text says he did this continually. So he's a godly man. He's a wealthy man. He's a family man. This guy is a machine. All right. So he is an example. He's a prototype that I could present to you gentlemen and ladies to say this is the kind of person you want to be. This tells you the significance of paying close attention to your character. This is why you pay attention to your character, verse 5. So, the text opens with there was a man. Now look at the transition in verse 6. There was a day. Now this is significant. So now we're moving from an earthly description of Job, and we're going to go into the heavenlies, as Ephesians 2 would talk about, or Revelation 4. There was a day when the sons of God, these are angelic hosts doing God's bidding, came to present themselves before the Lord, and the text says Satan came also among them. That should be fascinating to you. So here you have angels reporting, doing the bidding of God, going in and out of the heavenlies, communicating with God and helping the saints. And alongside of them, Satan also came among them. So that tells you something. Satan has access to God. So he can do that. Now, we would fast forward into Revelation 12 and other places, and we'd learn that Satan is an accuser of the brethren. He's always going before God and trying to point out in our lives sins and say, see, they're not committed to you. They don't love you. Look what they're doing. And he's always doing that before the throne of God. And so this is a classic text to clarify that he has access to God and that he's bringing accusation. Now look at verse 7. The Lord said to Satan, from where did you come? Now why is that striking? What? Yeah. God's omniscient, right? So God knows everything. He has perfect intelligence. God knew where Satan was. Who do you think he's asking that question for? Why is God asking, where have you been, Satan? He's not doing it for his benefit. He's doing it for our benefit. What?
Isn't it believed in the Greek time that Satan or Hades was also the brother of God?
Uh-uh. It could be Greek mythology, yes, but not scripture. Yeah. Right. Yep. So, why is it fascinating?
They both already know the
Well, they both know the answer,
but he's doing it for our benefit. God's trying to teach us something here. He's trying to teach us about the activity of Satan. From where did you come? Satan answered, God knew. Satan answered, the Lord said, from roaming about on the earth and walking around it. So here he is having access to God, and he's roaming the earth. When we fast forward into the New Testament, what do we learn from 1 Peter 5? Satan is like a what? Like a roaring lion, roaming about, seeking whom he may devour. So Peter says, you need to understand that Satan's like a ferocious king of the beast, a roaring lion, seeking whom he will devour. Here you have it in the Old Testament, the picture here. Here's the principle you need to understand for leadership in respect to your character. You are always being hunted. You are prey. You have a big bullseye on your back. So when you choose to follow Jesus Christ and you choose to be a leader, you also choose to spend the rest of your life being hunted. Now, for us, we don't live in lion country, right? I mean, we don't. Do you have lions in Uganda? So here's a Ugandan pastor who lives among, or at least near, lions. I mean, lions are an incredible killing machine. They stalk their prey. I mean, they grow up to 8 feet in length, up to almost 500 pounds. They can eat up to 15 pounds of meat a day, and they hunt with a pack. And so they bring you into the prey and the pry, and then the pride, and then everybody attacks, and they're killing machines, and they're carnivorous. And this is the picture. Now, to someone living in lion country, that would be significant. I mean, that's a huge threat. A lion coming into a village and killing its people and eating them would be a huge threat. So you've got to understand that this is a significant understanding of Satan. You, if you choose to be a leader this afternoon and you choose to have character, please understand you're being hunted. And that's scary. Question?
I got a question for him.
Go ahead.
Is it true that, like, if a lion has strayed off by himself away from the pack, if you, like, go near it and you don't show it any danger, is it true that it will not attack you?
You just stay away from him.
Why would you want to do that?
I think probably it's even more dangerous when it's out of the pack, because usually when they're out of the pack, they're older and they're dispensed. And so it's hard for them to... So you're actually prone to more danger in case you find a lion bites you.
Right. Okay. That leads into this. This is very important. When you're being hunted, he looks for the easy prey. So he looks for the young man or the young lady who doesn't have their character intact, who's easily distracted, who's wounded in some capacity, and he goes after him. And the kill is made. So the analogy is this. You're being hunted. You are prey. When you choose to be set apart, when you choose to make a difference in the world and make a dent in the universe, you choose to lead a basketball team, baseball team, whatever you choose to lead, know this. You then become the bigger prey, the bigger target on your back. So when God asks Satan, where have you been? He didn't do it for Satan's benefit. He did it for our benefit, right? Okay, now let's consider, let's move on. The Lord said to Satan, who initiates this little interchange? The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? So this is God putting Job forward and saying, he's such a man of character. He's such a leader. Why don't you put him to the test?
That's what he's daring
Satan. Exactly. He's calling Satan out and says, hey, if your premise is true and he'll fall like a house of cards, then why don't you put him to test? And so then the Lord repeats his character. Then Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? So what's Job's premise? Job's premise is this. Lord, you're blessing your servant, and because of all the benefits and because of all the kind things and all the blessings you do, that's why he's following you. He's not following you because he loves you and he trusts you. He's following you because of all the bennies, all the things that the blessings, all the extra stuff. And so he's not really following you because tough times haven't become him yet. He hasn't experienced radical difficulty. And so Satan's premise is this: true saving faith can be undermined. God's premise is this: true saving faith can't be undermined. If you're truly a Christian, you'll remain a Christian. You're not going to fall away from that. You're going to be steadfast. You're going to have resistance. And you're going to be able to overcome, and you're going to have victory. Satan says, no, it's just because you're blessing them. And people are always kind when you give them stuff. You give them stuff, they follow you. So that's his premise. Verse 10, Satan says, have you not put a hedge about him and his house and every side? I mean, give me a break. You've blessed the work of his hands, his possessions. It's clear from verse 3. I mean, he's loaded. But if you put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, he'll surely curse you to your face. And here's the shocking verse here. Look at verse 12. Then the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him physically. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. So this is an interchange between God and Satan. To validate Job's character, God allows Satan to have access to Job's possession and Job's life. So another premise or another point that needs to be made here is that Satan's not omnipowerful. He has to submit himself to God. He can't do anything. But you're about to see he controls wind, animals, I mean, all the things that take place here, human wills. I mean, extremely powerful. So you don't want to underestimate him, but you don't want to overestimate Satan either. You want to have a proper devilology. You want to understand that he has access, but he's not omniscient. He's not omnipowerful. He can't do everything, and he has to submit to God's leadership. So this is not a battle between good and evil and God and Satan. This is Satan submitting to God, saying, yeah, if you let me have him, that's fine, but if you don't, I understand. But he's kind of challenging God back, saying, if you let me have him, I promise you, he'll collapse. He just won't have the character. He won't be able to resist. And so as we leave verse 12, that's the scene. So it starts out on earth with a description of Job's character. Then it moves to the heavenlies, so you can see that Satan is powerful. He can go back and forth, but he has limited power. And you can see the premise that is levied towards God about this man's character. And then God says, okay, he's yours. Go get him and see what he does. But God's saying, I'll bet all the marbles that because of his character, he's not going to panic in a crisis. You know why? Because he's a leader. Look at verse 13. Now on the day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. So it's feast time, as mentioned back there in 4 and verse 5, right? A messenger came to Job at his house and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans attacked. These are terrorists, Sabaean terrorists attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So knock at the door, guy shows up, and someone has said, look, the oxen and donkeys were plowing and feeding, the Sabaeans attacked, killed all the servants, and took all of the animals. So this is half of his livestock herd had taken it. And Job's like, wow, that's intense. I mean, half of his business gone in a single terrorist-like attack. But while he's still standing there, look at verse 16. While he's still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven, so lightning, and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped you. So these lightning bolts from heaven flash, Satan controls the elements, bang, burns up the sheep and the servants. Oh man, that's intense. Verse 17, while he's still speaking, keep in mind this is a single afternoon, gentlemen. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Okay, so stop right there. Basically, everything in verse 3 is gone. And you know, it's going to really be hard to rebuild. It's going to be tough to find an employee because everybody that's worked for him has died in the single day. So it's going to be hard to go out and find new employees when the rumors get out that if you work for Job, I mean, he was a thriving titan of his day, but everybody that worked for him died. So he's feeding 11,000 mouths. They're all gone. Everyone's dying. And you can just picture here Job being overwhelmed. In between verse 17 and 18, that white space there, just picture the gut shot that this man at the zenith of his career has experienced. I mean, he's crushed. But I can only imagine, to use my sanctified imagination, he's probably thinking, you know, I still have my family. We can rebuild the family business. You know, we can recover. I mean, I built one, I'll build another, right? So there's some measure of hope, even if you're not a Christian, there'd be some measure of, wow, I was successful as an entrepreneur. I'll do it again, right? So he's thinking, at least I have my family. Look at verse 18. While he was still speaking, this is messenger of doom number 4. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, Job Jr. And behold, a great wind, a tornado, came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they all died, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Okay, so family business gone. Now, all 10 children were in the house feasting. Tornado hits it, collapse, kills everybody in a single afternoon. I mean, this is a day from hell. This is a personal nightmare. And Job's thinking, exactly, still has his wife at this point, but Job's thinking, man, this has to be unbelievable anguish and turmoil, right? So here's the point. You're in the middle of a crisis, right? This is the crisis of all crises. How are you going to respond? I'm telling you, if you understand character as king, then that means in a crisis, you're not going to panic. Because what comes next will be your second nature. Look at verse 20. Then Job arose from the ground. So he's crushed. He's found himself prostrate on the ground. He arose from the ground. He tears his robe, which is a sign of contrition and anguish and inner turmoil. He somehow gains the composure there in verse 20 to shave his head. You notice there? He shaves his head in a sign of contrition, because hair was the glory of a man, shaved his head, and he fell back to the ground, so he flops back on the ground. Now, at this point, you're thinking, Satan's won, right? I mean, he crushed him, he pummeled him, he smashed him to the ground, and Satan is going to be victorious. Satan's the one that's going to win. But not to a man whose character is king and refuses to panic. Look at verse 20, the end of it. He fell to the ground and he did what? Worshipped. That is a staggering phrase. That's one worthy of underlining in your text. He didn't fall to the ground and curse God. He didn't fall to the ground and ask, why is this happening to me? He fell to the ground and he worshipped the one true God. Why? Because he knew that God controls every single molecule. Nothing happens to him that is not passed through the hand and mind and heart of God. And that God allowed all this to happen in his life. And that he would not. He would not, because he was a man of character. He would not collapse. He would not throw in the towel. He would not quit the faith. This is leadership. And second nature to a man of character is the fact that he will not panic and that he will result in always worship. I'll tell you what, I have seen more people collapse and throw in the towel for far less than Job experienced in this life. I mean, they've gone through a measure of suffering, but never to the extent of total loss of finances, total loss of family in a single day. Some people have lost their business. Some people have lost a child. Not 10 in a day. This is his life. Does that not stun you? Is that not a stunning verse? That tells me that leaders don't panic. That is a fundamental principle for a leader. So no matter what comes your way, you make good decisions because you have been in the practice and discipline of feeding your soul and growing and had a sanctification work ethic second to none that has informed your ability to worship God regardless. Look at his perspective. Verse 21. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. He's basically saying, I came into this life naked. If God chooses to leave me with nothing and I leave naked, then so be it. Look at verse 22. Through all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. That's leadership. That's classic leaders don't panic leadership. And he trusted his theology. He had such a high view of God and such a solid theology of who God was that he knew whatever happened to his life had passed through the hand of God in his sovereignty and that he would pillow his head on the sovereignty of God that evening. And that is what character looks like in real shoe leather. That's what character looks like on the ground. That's what character looks like on the street right there. And that's why leaders don't panic. Now, let me tell you some things he didn't have that you do have. He didn't have a church. Church is not established yet. He didn't have a Bible, first book written. So please understand, when this is happening to Job, we're reading back in time. Job is just a dude living and never, he didn't know what was going on. All he had no Bible. He had no small group. He had no youth ministry, no high school to hang out with, no buddies, no mentors. It's Job, 10 kids, this titan. He had no scripture to lean into. He had no wisdom, none of it. This is the stunning thing about his life. And the text says he worshiped and had clear thinking, clear theology, and refused in his heart to blame God for that because of his high view. Go ahead.
How does Job know that's the real God? You know that the God that he's worshiping is the right God.
Because he would just understand that's the theology. I mean, he would understand who God is, and that was his only option.
But how did he find out about it? Because like for us, we get the scripture, so we know about it that way. But he didn't.
Well, what was behind all this?
Yeah, like,
he wouldn't have known until he got to heaven.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, like,
how was he supposed to pray to God if he wasn't? If this is what tells us about God, but
right. Well,
yeah.
Right. That was through God speaking to him and through all that. Yeah. Through the prophets, through people that lived in that era, as the word was transmitted. It's a verbal word at that point. It's not been canonized, not been written down yet. So it's passed on. Yeah. Just like, I mean, Adam and Eve and passed on through the generations. Right. But he's short after this. I mean, he would have known. He'd been in close proximity. So this is not much time has passed when this account's happening. So yeah, I mean, I think sometimes back then I would think for Job, access to wisdom of God would be more difficult, right? Our issue is not access. Your issue is not access. You've got podcasts. You can listen to sermons. You can listen to teachers. You can go to Wednesday night youth group. I mean, there's just tons of stuff available to you. Ours is not access, our issue. Ours is application. We're not applying the word as much as we should. So this is what's mind-blowing about Job. This is why I think a story paints a wonderful picture. It's worth 1,000 words of teaching, 1,000 explanations. To see a man go through a day like this, this is a day from hell, and emerge out of that victorious, not sinning in his heart, and worshiping, that just signifies to me that's leadership at its best. That's a picture of what it means to live an exemplary life. That he's not going to blame God. He's not going to blame anybody else. He's going to say, okay, God, you're in control. You're sovereign. And I'm going to trust you. So he was only left with faith and trust as a leader in God. And that's what keeps you from panicking. You don't panic when situations come because you trust God. You have faith in God. There was a question over here.
Oh, you answered.
Okay. This is faith and trust at its very best. So tell me, what does this do in your thinking? When you see a story or encounter a story like this, and it's very clear this was a real man. This isn't a made up story. James confirms it was a real man. Matter of fact, let's listen to what James said about Job, because that's key. Verse 11. Well, verse 10, as an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord, who count those blessed who endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. So James says, have you heard of the endurance of Job? In other words, the Christian life is not a sprint, it's a marathon, right? That's fundamental to leadership. You see the endurance of Job. You see his resilience. You see him willing to stand firm and to stand fast in the faith because he trusted God. Leaders don't panic. You have to know that. And you will panic if you don't have character. If you don't have 1 to 5 there, when you're faced with 6 to 12 or 13 to 18, you will get crushed. Because you won't be able to bear up under that kind of weight. But this is all happening to Job in a single day. And he could only imagine, did I do something wrong? No, I've been doing everything right. I've been following the Lord from day one. I've even been dutifully caring for my kids so that they wouldn't sin. I can go out of my way and to care for them and to shepherd them and to minister to them. So what does this passage do to you?
Kind of like with Steve Saint when he was talking about losing his daughter. It's more of a real faith than people where everything's going good.
Right. So in good times, it's hard to discern someone's robust faith or capacity of faith because anybody can fall. That's what Satan was saying. Anybody can follow the Lord if it's good, but put him to the test and see if it stands up. And Satan was saying he won't stand up because why? He looked at the vast majority of people out there. And they collapse under such of that. They throw in the towel and they quit. I quit. It's too hard. Life's too hard. And they throw in the towel. Not Job. So that's why I say Job's a leader. Other people are not. He had the capacity. And he had it because his character was there. Right. God's sovereignly in control of his life. Every molecule, he got that from day one. Because I think you're right, especially in the West, we have this entitlement mentality. Like we deserve certain things. We always get certain things, kind of the American dream, you know, a house, picket fence, wife, kids, everything's perfect. You know, get to do all this stuff. That's not guaranteed in the scriptures, as you can just about see here. I mean, that's a Western mindset, but that's not a biblical mindset. And so we forget that, and that's why Job is a shocking passage, you know, in our thinking.
I think Job had two things that, one, he had a love for God, and two, that, like you said, he knew that God was sovereign in all things, because he could just, after all that, just took him the easy route, just like commit suicide or something, because find what you have to lose, you're going to see all your kids and stuff, but no, he realized God is sovereign, and he also loved God, so he knew that this was God's plan and love for life, and so he just didn't quit.
Right. See, it's all going to come down to your view of God. If you have a high view of God, it's going to affect how you live, right? And so leaders have to have a high view of God. That's why you work on your character. That's why you do all these things. Absolutely. Anything else? Any other comments? Joshua, what you got back there? What you thinking?
Well, I think
tell for me not to sin, you know, blame God, and just showing how we need to be more like Job.
Absolutely. So in a crisis like that, Job's not asking why. He's kind of asking who. Okay, Lord, I'm going to trust in you. I want to know you in this. He's not asking the sinful questions from man's perspective. He's just saying, look, you're in control, and I know theologically that you control everything. So this, in other words, God's never been surprised. He's never been duped. He's never had an aha moment. He is complete, perfect intelligence, knows all things. So this whole thing, in Job's mind, he knew that this wouldn't have taken God by surprise, so he's allowed it. Therefore, I'm going to embrace it and trust him no matter what. I mean, that's a high view of God. That's not a low view of God. That's a high view of God. And I'm telling you, it's a result of, look at verse 1. He was blameless, upright. What did he do? He feared God, and he kept himself as far away from evil as possible. That's the result. So, character is king, leadership principle number one. Two, leaders don't panic because their character is king. When they get that, they won't panic in a crisis. Their second nature is to worship and not to resist and not to sin and not to question, but to trust God. That is leadership. Question? Stretching. What's your thoughts? Give us your best thoughts.
Well, it shows you like who Job put first before like his business and his family. Because instead of mourning, he worshiped God because he lost stuff, which is seems crazy. But I guess it's what you're supposed to do.
It's counterintuitive. So that's what the world does. The world will say, oh, what a tragedy. I mean, he's lost his business. He can't hire anybody back. I mean, then on top of that, insult to injury, is he lost his kids. This is horrific. This is the worst case scenario in this life.
And
he worshipped. Yep.
It almost like he already had that predecided in his mind. Who was first?
Well, that's exactly. Remember what we talked about yesterday with Dr. Moore when Russ got up there. He talked. You know, we talked about it a little bit when I asked you that question. You predetermine the line. You got to know your theology. If you don't know this book, you're in trouble as a leader. You're just going to flounder. You're not going to have discernment. You know, you're not going to have wisdom. But if you know this book, it's going to aid you in making wise leadership-like and decisions. So he had already predetermined he was going to worship God no matter what. So when he was crushed, that was his second nature. That was his normal response to anything, was to worship God. But that didn't come from shallow, weak sermonettes for Christianettes, sermon lights and Christian light and reading your Bible once a month and dusting off your bookshelf on your bunk beds, gentlemen and ladies. That came from being a serious student of God. So the question is, if you want to be a leader, are you a serious student of God's Word? Are you working hard at your character? You've got a sanctification work ethic second to none? Because this is the kind of stuff that builds leaders, Christian leaders. Not shallow, weak, skilled guys, but character-driven leadership, which I believe and would purport to you and propose to you that that is biblical leadership. Character is king. Leaders don't panic. Further questions? Yes, sir.
Your integrity, interpret, you should feel out of the fact that God has blessed you. Now, since God is casting you out, so, you know, I forget that stuff. It's no longer beneficial to you. But how he answers, he says, when he says, ask God and die, and he says to her, you speak as one of the creation and speaks. Shall we indeed accept God from source? Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. But that shows, like, I mean, whether God gives you good or bad, he's still worshiping who he is and what he's giving you. And to me, that's a great lesson, because at times I feel like I more look to, you know, God has given me this and this and this. And for that reason, I ought to. I mean, if he removes that, probably I would just forget you.
Right. Oh, it's huge. That's a great, great verse. And what I fear for some of you young guys is, and gals, is that, you know, you're in it for all the good that God brings, and He is a good God. I do not want to discount that in any way. You know, everything comes down from the Father of Lights, James 1. He's a good and awesome God. But bad things happen to good people. And the question is, will you have faith when that happens too? So everything's going along smooth. You have minimal responsibility in life right now. Life's pretty easy. Life's good for you in your little world right now. But life can be challenging, and it can be a dark place. And we live in a Genesis 3 world, and difficulty and trials do come. I want you to have the same faith in the light as you do in the darkness. Or the same faith in the darkness as you do in the light. If you learn that lesson, you will be a tremendous leader. Because you know why? When you suffer, and you suffer well, and you don't waste your trials, when people look at you who don't know Jesus Christ, they're going to say, how is that possible? And you know what you're going to do? You're going to pull them aside and sit on a step, or sit in a living room, or sit in their home, and you're going to say, you know how that's possible? Because I have faith in Jesus Christ alone. And you're going to have the opportunity to share the gospel with them. Because of your faith, it's going to be contagious. It's like salt and light to them, and you'll be a salty, well-lit Christian, and your life will be what we're going to talk about in the morning, gospel-driven. That's what leaders do. They're driven by the advance of the kingdom and not their own kingdom. Life's not about them. It's about Jesus Christ, and it's going to open the door. It's like a pre-evangelism when they see your faith in God. Like drinking water from a fire hydrant. Kind of tough stuff, huh? It is. I didn't want to give you baby food. You want to be leaders? Starts right now. Working on our character, working on our endurance.